my name is George Tinker, and that I prefer to be called Tink, and that the title of this session is A Native American Theology, Part Two. And it's a continuation of the business we were talking about yesterday, remembering the past and dreaming the future. And I want to remind you that the image of dreaming the future for me comes from Tzitzinako, the thought woman in Laguna culture, and that in Silko's story Ceremony, thought woman in the very opening poem of the novel is thinking a story into existence. And I'm suggesting that we use that as a metaphor for thinking how we will create a new vision. We've got to dream the dream before this new vision can become a reality. We have to be talking about ideals before they will happen. If nobody's talking about it, it won't happen. Last time, I suggested that there were some significant cultural differences between find one of the words, Euro-American culture and Indian culture, and I want to hang on to those. That your American cultures are temporal, and individualistic. Those are the two most important. Whereas Indian cultures tend to be spatial, and communitarian. So I want to use that as a starting point. What the spatial aspect of Indian life means is that we are definitely rooted in places. There are places that we come from, that our nations come from, that are in fact more than just sentimentally important to us, but they are a part of our life. So that trading pieces of land doesn't work as well for Indian people as it does for other peoples in North America. You can't move a sacred site. Especially if it has a spiritual essence about it, it's there, and you don't pick up the spirits in that place and move them somewhere else. It's like moving a hot springs. You don't move a hot springs. If you have one where you are, you're lucky and you use it. But you don't create a hot spring somewhere else. Instead, we build jacuzzis. Hot tubs. So having said that much to summarize where we were last time. Well, I guess I should say one more thing. That we're talking about how to imagine a world in which the cycle of violence that seems to have marked this society in North America today can be brought to an end, so that the violence can be replaced by the in that gospel reading from our Vespers the other night, the great calm can ensue in the midst of chaos. And remember also that I'm suggesting that there are some aspects of American Indian culture that can be instructive to your American peoples in North America in terms of how to reshape our vision our worldview, our perception of reality in ways that are less violent and more community building. So that's where we were last time. I want to pick it up from there. And I'd like to begin with a story, at least one story. But let me ask you all, especially those who were here yesterday, are there any comments, leftover questions or queries from yesterday that we need to address before we move on?
There was one that I thought about as we were ending yesterday that I made to you, and I just, for me, these are important, but the other one that's important for me is the difference between the concrete and the abstract, that there's a difference between fact and truth. That's an important concept for me, too. That's a big difference between the cultures.
That's a tough one to deal with because it gets oversimplified sometimes. It turns out, for instance, that Indian cultures are terribly complex cultures as opposed to your American culture, which is, in the scheme of things, is a simpler culture. Indian peoples can be very abstract.
Oh, correct. That's what when I've talked to even my kids sometimes, and I will tell them what I feel to be a fact. You know, some of my kids have a different cultural background than I have, and to them, the facts are irrelevant. It's what's true. And they do have a different sense of the difference between.
So you're saying the opposite of what I thought you were saying.
I think European cultures are very concrete in their storytelling, and I think that the Indian cultures, that those that I'm aware of, tend to think more in the abstract, in the myth, not the fact of the story, but the truth of the story.
One of the problems is that North Americans, Europeans in general, Euro-Americans included, think that they have somehow risen above mythology. But the truth is that Europeans are rooted in a mythology that they're not even aware of.
Well, we're looking at the commonness of dreams a lot now, and dreams in the commonness of cultures as well. And I think that's where our continuation as a people, a global people, is.
I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more on that. That's a very confusing area to me. The difference between facts, between cultures, and you just said we have our own mythology in the way we tell stories and stuff. We don't think we do.
Right. Right.
And if you could maybe say a little more about that.
I think it's pertinent. I think maybe I should start there instead of going right into my story. Let me give you an example of modern biblical criticism that will, I think, explain this strange notion that somehow modern Euro-Americans or Europeans have no mythology. There was a biblical scholar, a Lutheran biblical scholar, who died about 20 years ago at an advanced age in his 90s, Rudolf Bultmann, who was the architect of a style of biblical interpretation that went by the name demythologization. And Bultmann worked to demythologize the Gospels in order to make them accessible and understandable to to modern European peoples. Now, one of Bultmann's personal examples of demythologization was, if you walk into a room in your house and you turn on the light, and the light doesn't come on, what do you do? Bultmann insisted, you check the bulb. Or you check the other rooms to see if the lights are out in other places. And if that's true, maybe you'll check the fuse box. In Bultmann's day, it was a fuse box. Today, it's a circuit breaker. Bultmann's day meaning, I mean, he was teaching in the 20s and 30s already. And failing that, you go out into the street to see if other houses have electricity, right? And if their power's out, there's a local outage and you have to wait until the power comes back on. Otherwise, what do you do?
Same smoke.
No, if none of that works, you've tried all that, what's the next step?
You write a funeral.
Wait.
But what if it's only your house that's out?
You make a phone call.
You can light a candle and that works for the moment. You can make a phone call to whom?
Probably. Why don't you can check the meaning of the light being out? What's going on in your own life?
How many Americans would do that before they called an electrician to fix it?
I think there's becoming more and more people.
Now be real. How many people in Seattle, if there are 2 million people in Seattle, how many would not call an electrician to fix the power first, fix the circuits in your house first? Two? Probably more than two, because there's some people who couldn't afford an electrician. All right? So if we screen out those who can't afford an electrician, what percentage of folk are going to not call an electrician first? See, that was Bultmann's point, that this culture functions outside of the parameters of biblical mythology. In Jesus' day, one turned to an exorcist. That's the first thing you do, is turn to an exorcist. No electric lights, of course, but if something goes wrong, you turn to an exorcist. Or a healer, or a miracle worker. Or you go to the temple and you look for healing there. But Bultmann's insistence that there's no mythology in the European, Euro-American mindset, I think is wrong. I think there is a deeply ingrained mythology. We're just not want to call it a mythology. Instead, we call it the truth, right? We call it the scientific method. We call it cause and effect. That's our mythology, is cause and effect. If there's an effect, you look for the cause. And if you have a cause, you predict the effect. And I want to suggest that that's mythology just as much as New Testament demonism. It's just a different kind of mythology. It's very powerful. It's put people on the moon. It's that powerful. But if you talk to theoretical physicists, you'll find that there's a whole bunch that they don't know. And those who are the quickest to sometimes challenge the mythology of cause and effect are those who are most deeply involved in it at a theoretical level. Right?
What's your definition of mythology?
A mythology is that story which undergirds the entire intellectual tradition of a people. So I'm not using mythology as a false, as a lie. You know, some people use myth as lie in contemporary usage, but its technical usage is It's a foundation story for a people's worldview. It's that which is the bedrock upon which we stand when we think about anything in our world, or even when we look at our world and try to understand what it is we're seeing.
In physics, Einstein has brought up a fundamental challenge to our way of understanding. The name escaped me, what it is.
Relativity?
Well, relativity, and there's something else. And that is so, this makes, when you read about it, it makes you very much aware of your own mythology, because it's very hard to understand, because you're reading it, and it doesn't, a lot of things don't make sense.
Uh-huh.
And
that's,
I think,
right.
this is the next big challenge to our intellectual understanding of the world.
Quantum mechanics.
Quantum mechanics, there we go. And very interesting stuff coming there. But it's hard for lay people to understand it, because we can't let go of our own mythology.
Well, see, that's right. I mean, what theoretical physicists teach is one thing, but what the rest of us have digested 30 or 40 years ago in high school is something else. And for some of us, that was our last connection with the world of physics, and hence we're rooted in this cause and effect mythology. You know, that is the bedrock upon which this society functions. Without it, the modern industrial complex collapses, capitalism collapses.
There's even some suggestion that linearity of time is a question by quantum mechanics. I wish I knew more about it, but that's just a little bit I've read, and that's kind of a fascinating idea.
If I can caricaturize Einstein, Einstein argued that if you could go fast enough, you could catch up with yourself. That's essentially what the theory of relativity is. If you can travel the speed of light, you can catch up with yourself.
Time would stop.
Time would stop.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So as opposed to the Indian culture.
Well, Einstein, of course, is extremely temporal. He's made even space a function of time, as it were. See, the Indian worldview, rooted as it is in place and community building, is constantly going to value then the world in a different way. As long as you're valuing the world in terms of the scientific method, in terms of cause and effect, there's the risk of reifying and materializing everything around us, so that the world becomes simply a material resource which is there for us to use up. Even our theologies, see, at this point, our theologies have tended at a popular level to buy into that. And Genesis doesn't help too much when God's command to the first human beings is to subdue the earth and have dominion over it. And boy, we've been subduing the earth with a vengeance. and in fact, we've subdued, you know, it's like dealing with abused kids. If you abuse your kids, they're going to come back to haunt you. And the earth is coming back to haunt us, because, in fact, the earth has been abused by those who have seen the earth merely as a material resource to call upon. Let me tell my story now. It has to do with the origin of tobacco among Blackfeet peoples just over the mountains here. So it's a Blackfeet story. And long ago, when the Blackfeet first had tobacco, there were four brothers who cornered the market on tobacco. They were the only ones that had tobacco seed, and they hoarded it and would not let it out of their possession. Hence, they grew the only tobacco that was available. It's very powerful medicine. Made their prayers very powerful as a result. Everyone in the community had to come to these four brothers for help when they needed spiritual help. Whether they needed healing, or there was a personal crisis in their clan or their family, or whether they needed help to ensure appropriate moisture to water the corn, whatever it was, they had to turn to these four brothers. And because they were so spiritually powerful, they were also materially powerful. They were the richest four people in the whole community by far. Well, there was one couple in the community who knew that this was wrong, that this violated the sacred and violated the way people are supposed to live together. So they went out to make a spiritual journey, a vision quest, if you will, to see if they could discover how to grow this tobacco for the whole people. So the man and the woman left the community, went out into the wilderness where they were to do this quest. And after several days of praying, several days of questing, of trying to get the kind of spiritual help they needed, while the man was off on a hillside looking, the woman was down at the lakeshore where she discovered a beaver dam and even discovered that she could remove a log from off of the beaver dam and could see the beavers inside their lodge. In fact, they were dancing and having a good time. And they got mad at her for opening the window and letting the cold in, or the warm in, whichever it was, and chewed her out for it. Finally, you know, when they were chewing her out for lifting this log off the dam, she was bold enough to say back to them, "Yeah, but we're out here on a spiritual quest looking for some answers, and instead of getting angry at me, maybe you could give me some help." And so the chief beaver asked the woman what it was she was looking for. She told him, "We're looking for tobacco because these four brothers have all the tobacco and we don't think it's right." And so the beaver gave her some directions and told her that she needed to prepare a feast for all the beavers, and that her husband would have to go and hunt these four animals to bring them back for this feast. And it gets to be a long and detailed story because, you know, bits of the story get retold at every turn in the story. But ultimately, the man, hearing his wife's story, goes off to hunt the four animals he needs to have this feast. And they prepare the feast. And when they prepare the feast, these beavers come up out of their lodge to participate in this feast. And as they come up out of the lodge, they're transformed into two-leggeds and sit down in the lodge of this man and woman and have their feast. And because they have proven themselves, the beavers consent to give them tobacco seed and all the directions about how to use it, how to plant it, how to save some seed, how to sing the songs that need to be sung in order to get the plants to grow, and the ceremony that goes with using the tobacco in your pipe. So when this was over, the man and the woman immediately found a place to plant their tobacco. They planted a field of tobacco and kept some seed back for in case of crop failure. And almost overnight in the story, tobacco springs up. And that very day, it turns out, there was some weird weather. There were thunderstorms and hail that came down in certain places, not everywhere. But it fell on those four brothers' tobacco crop and destroyed their crop. And they, it turned out, had failed to hold back some seed. And so they were completely wiped out. And they began to hear rumors of this man and this woman who had seed and had planted it and were growing tobacco. And so they rushed over to find this man and this woman to co-opt them, to make them a part of the guild, of the tobacco guild, so that they then, six instead of four, could corner the market on tobacco and still have the kind of power that they had in the community before. But it was too late. The man and the woman had not only given tobacco to everyone in the community, they even gave everybody seeds so that everybody could plant their own tobacco crop. The point of the story is those spiritual resources and even material resources are not there to enrich one part of the community, but they're there for the whole of the community. And it's only when the whole of the community has access to resources that there's harmony and balance in the world and in that community. So those four power brokers had to be disempowered before the community could live in harmony and in balance. That's typical of so many Indian stories. Let me give you another one from another tribe to show you what I think is an aspect of universality here. There's a story about a beast, a river beast, who was very destructive in the middle of the American continent at some point in the past. The monster's name was Ushigila. And many warriors had tried to serve the people by going out to kill Ushigila. They inevitably failed because this monster's power was such that even seeing the monster caused the death of the hunter. But these two brothers decided that somehow they were in better shape than the other hunters and that they could hunt and kill this monster with some spiritual help. One of these brothers was blind, and so they had a plan. They went to Two-Faced Woman up in the Black Hills and enlisted her help. And the story gets detailed here too. I mean, Two-Faced Woman is about as ugly and smelly an old woman as you can imagine. And she wouldn't help the boys unless one of them consented to make love to her. And the guy who could see said to his brother who can't see, "I think you should do it because you're blind and you won't be turned off by her ugliness." And he agrees and makes love to her. And just in the lovemaking, that's why they call her Two-Faced Woman, she transforms into the most beautiful Indian woman that the one had ever seen. And he was jealous of his brother for a bit there. But she gives them sacred arrows, woman. She gives them sacred arrows, four of them. And they're to shoot all of these arrows into the beast. And she promises that these arrows will find their mark if you aim in the general direction. They'll hit the seventh red spot at the base of the neck of this monster, Ushigila. So they head out then for finding Ushigila. And they have a plan that the brother who can see is going to watch for the surface of the water to break when Ushigila comes out of the water. And then he's going to duck down behind a rock. And they're to count to 7 to give the monster time to rear up completely out of the water. And then the blind brother's going to stand up and shoot those 4 arrows into the neck of Ushigila. And it works. The arrows find their mark. Ushigila is slain. But then they've got to remember everything the two-faced woman told them. So the first thing is, they've got to cut out the heart of this monster, or the monster will come back to life. So they run over and cut out the heart of the monster. And then the next thing they have to do is take some of the blood of that monster and wipe it on the eyes of the young man who is blind. And they do that, and his sight comes back. He can see. And then they take the heart as she had told them to, and they dig a deep pit. They have to, now, there is nothing you do in the Indian world that brings power and prestige without responsibility. They're now responsible for taking care of this heart in this deep pit. So they place the heart in the deep pit and build a lodge over that pit. No one is permitted, except for these two boys, to go in and see that heart. If anyone else goes in and sees the heart will be destroyed and their power will be gone. So every day they have to feed this heart. Every day they have to sing songs to it, ceremony, pray with it. But in return, they became immensely powerful. They were the best hunters, the best warriors, the best gamesmen, the best lovers. It turned out that they never had want for, you know, the love of a woman, or the warmth of a woman's body by them. Every woman in the community wanted to sleep with these men. Even married women were doing what we call teepee creeping in order to find their way into these brothers' tent. And the people were prosperous because of these brothers' power. There was always food. There was plenty of everything, plenty of hides for building lodges and making clothes and tools, etc., weapons. But these young men became bored with their power. They became bored being the best at everything because it was never a contest. They became bored with having women at their beck and call. They became bored with life in general. And they finally decided, we need to just get rid of this heart so that we can live like everyone else. And so, on the day they determined, they invited everyone in the community to come and see the source of their power. And so person after person filed through the lodge, looked down in the pit and saw that heart at the bottom. And the more people that saw it, the more the heart shriveled up and dried, and finally it was just gone. And those young men, the power of those young men withered as that heart withered. And suddenly they had no special gifts and were reduced to living like everyone else. Now, third story.
What people is that from? What tradition?
As Lakota. Third story. And this one is short. It's a true story. In the late 30s, early 40s, an Indian man went to Chicago to work in the defense industry. It was common. There were many that did this. This man worked for 20 years. And finally, in the early 60s, was able to retire. And retire with a nice nest egg, a retirement package from this defense factory where he had made guns, bullets, bombs, who knows. In those days, your $20,000 or $30,000 retirement package was a lot. And it was paid to him in lump sum. So he had a check, made a bank deposit, and he was set pretty much for the rest of his life, went back to his reservation. And within 6 months had spent all of his retirement on gifts and necessities for all of his relatives on the rest. And when he had spent all of his retirement, then he went over to the tribal office and applied for tribal housing. You know, today it would be HUD housing, substandard by any measure. Certainly a lot less than the chalets here at Holden Village. Moved into his new HUD house and settled down to live out the remainder of his life as one of the people on an equal level with all of the people there in poverty. Not a very European story, but a pretty good Indian story. Now stop for a bit and y'all can engage me.
But it's a good Christian story, that last one. It's a good Christian story. That's what Jesus has called us to do, that type of thing.
Well, certainly in Acts 4 you have Christians living in common together, putting all their resources together. There's nothing unchristian about it, we know that for sure. It's probably more Christian than capitalism can ever hope to be. Do my stories make a point? Do they illustrate what I'm trying to say? We live in such a consumerist world, predicated so much on each one of us cornering as much of the economic surplus pie as we can and sticking it away into a retirement account or even upping our annual salary so that we can spend more now and consume more now. But that story is, to me, a rather strong counterbalance.
One of the, seems to be a common thread in their stories is the awareness gained of the fact that, not like for the tobacco growers, that if the power doesn't come from the people, and that when people try to grab their power by controlling economics or grab the power from out here and pull it in, there's never enough. Because what needs to happen is the connection to the source, and the source is within. So the couple went on the vision quest, and she discovers the beavers doing the dance in their dam. And they then transform and become teachers and say, we're going to give you that power so that you it cannot be held over you. Mm-hmm. So that is then distributed. And they fight the temptation to then join those four brothers who had all the tobacco and say, no, we've already given the seeds away. We've given that power and distributed it. So that came into them from within because it was a vision. And they found the product and they said, this is it. We're going to distribute the power. So they became conduits for that source energy, where the selfishness that is usually sort of expected in our society, it's a complete turnaround. And I'm wondering when the European culture started to intrude, this is a good word, on the Native American cultures, how did the Native American peoples react to that? Because it must have been very new to their to the culture. That what do you do with people who are now selfish and taking away everything?
Yeah. There's
one thing that I know personally about having met many Americans is not understanding the real estate industry. How do you buy land
that's
not yours to begin with?
That isn't a quantity. It's not a material quantity that can be dealt in. Land has its own life. It's a relative. It's the earth. Years ago, there's a new book with a long technical essay tracing the biography of Nicholas Black Elk. Nicholas Black Elk is the protagonist in John Neihardt's book, Black Elk Speaks. I mean, he never lets on that Black Elk has a first name, because it's more Indian just to be Black Elk. But Nick actually was, there's something else that Neihardt doesn't tell you. When Neihardt first met Black Elk had been a Catholic catechist for 14 years. And was the leading Catholic catechist, Indian catechist, in South Dakota. But in this biography, Raymond DeMalion, anthropologist at Indiana University, reports what some of the priests actually thought of Nick. They called him a beggar, especially the priests that worked closest with him, because Black Elk would come to him for $5 at a time almost daily, crying poverty and saying he needed the money. Black Elk, we're told also in this biography, loved to travel as a catechist because he always got travel monies and always had extra that he brought home with him. So that DeMalion leaves you with the impression that Nick Black Elk really was a beggar, that that's what he was about. He also tells you, but he doesn't tie it into the story, that Black Elk used that $5 at a time to spread around the community to make sure that the people who lived in his community were well taken care of. In other words, he didn't pocket the money, he was using it to take care of the community.
So you're distributing income.
I'd be a beggar too if I could spread it around the community, and sometimes I think that's my function in the ELCA, is to pry resources loose from you all so I can spread it around the Indian community. So there's a value there that's being illustrated. And it's not much different today. I mean, yes, you have people who are, you know, we've been thoroughly colonized and to a certain extent assimilated. I certainly have, as a professor at a Christian seminary, I have a retirement account that I'm not spreading around the community, because I know that when I die, when I retire, I'm going to be living on my own resources. That there's not going to be people to take care of me the way there were, say, 100 years ago among the Osages. In Osage culture, let me just go back and pick this up for you a little bit. We have a council of elders called the Nahonjinga, the little old ones. And they make the principal decisions for the people. Now, in the Indian world, we distinguish between elders and the elderly. White New Agers don't. They just go find any old Indian and assume that what they're getting is what they need. But we distinguish between elders and the elderly. And we take care of our elderly, but we treasure our elders because they're the ones constantly teaching us how to be in the world. So the Nahonjinga is a council of elders. And there's a formal procedure for being elected to the Council of Elders. You know, we look for a set of criteria that includes four particular categories. They've got to be people who are exceptionally bright because they have ceremonial responsibilities that involve memorizing four-day ceremonies, many of them. And they have to know their part all the way through the ceremony. So we look for intelligence. Secondly, we look for moral stature in the community. By moral stature, we're not talking sexuality now. We're talking about people who have actually contributed to the well-being of the community appropriately, who have taken that seriously all their life, because even in a traditional village, there will be those who take it more seriously and those who take it less seriously. It's not that greed is not a factor in the Indian world. It's that we have sets of stories and teachings to mitigate against the exercise of human greed in our communities. So we look for someone who is morally upstanding. Thirdly, we want a warrior. Somebody who has earned all 13 of the war honors of his division. Or if it's a woman whose husband has earned those 13 war honors. And fourthly, we're looking for somebody who's generous. Somebody who has ceremonially given away everything they own at least three times in their lifetime. And this ceremonial giveaway isn't just a decision tomorrow to give away everything you've got. No, you decide 2 years ahead of time and spend 2 years collecting particularly nice things to give away, whether they're craft items or tools or lodges or skins. Then, when you've given everything away, including the lodge you live in, you're reduced to dependence on the community. You have to rely on your friends and relatives taking care of you. Now that really is a built-in bonding mechanism called diabolical by the missionaries. Because if you're busy giving away everything, you don't have much to put in the offering plate when you go to church, right? I mean, that still marks the community today. If you go to any powwow, you'll find that at a typical powwow, there will be four specials where people have giveaways. I mean, those who are selected, honored by being the head dancers, head man dancer, head woman dancer, head girl dancer, head boy dancer, all four of those families will have a giveaway to honor the community for the honor they've received of being head dancer in the powwow. And we'll choose a head dancer not because they can have a giveaway, but because they're good dancers and they're the kinds of people we want to see showcasing how it is other people should dance. Well, you know, if you pick somebody poor, it's going to be a poor giveaway. In fact, the rest of us may have to actually contribute to their giveaway in order for them not to be embarrassed in the community. So it's a time for the rest of us even to pitch in. Well, that's the kind of stuff that keeps the community as a community. It just enhances the bonding within the community.
Is the giveaway that sounds a lot like the potlatch?
Very similar, yes.
Uh-huh. Is the purpose of the giveaway, probably twofold, to emphasize the separation from material things, that's not yours, that's not ours, or is it the purpose primarily generosity, spreading the good among the community, or is it both?
It's both. It is both. It's predominantly the latter, because generosity is one of the cardinal virtues of Indian people, almost in every tribal context that I know of.
There's there's no evidence that the year of Jubilee ever occurred, but there is an Old Testament precedent for something similar, in that everything would have to revert back to a different, you know, everything would have to revert back to a different ownership.
There's no evidence that the year of Jubilee did not occur.
Yeah, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right, either way. Yeah, right. Modern scholars are too quick to say it never happened.
But we don't know.
Yeah, yeah, but they're too quick to say it never happened, it's not practical, it can't happen. But it could happen. It really could.
You were talking about mythologies, and don't you think that one of the most unrecognized myths that is operative in this culture is the myth of rugged individualism?
But that's myth in a different sense. That's myth in the sense of lie. I think that is a common illusion. That, a common illusion of rugged individualism. In fact, in the stories of the pilgrims, you know, we remember that kind of heroism, forgetting conveniently that both in Virginia and at Plymouth, those communities would have died in the first two winters if it hadn't been for the generosity of Indian people who shared their food with those first English immigrants to this continent.
And the pilgrims didn't even know how to plant their own food, too. They were shown how to survive longer.
Especially in Virginia.
Yeah.
Especially in Virginia, because those were gentlemen, so-called, who didn't come to work. It's like the Spanish in the South. The Spanish, you know, we talk about the European work ethic or the Protestant work ethic. They expected Indian slave labor to do the work, or eventually black slave labor to do the work. Their work was beneath them. So there's another illusion that we've built up for ourselves, that somehow we've made this country by dint of hard work. Well, there was a lot of hard work, but there was a lot of sloth too, and a lot of using other people's labor.
The program recently on PBS 500 Nations and talked about the Thanksgiving and the fact that you just mentioned, and also mentioned that soon after the Indians had given everything they had to the settlers, that all those Indian peoples were all massacred by the English.
In Plymouth, the winter of 1620-1621, the Indians help the pilgrims survive. In 1622, the military captain of the expedition, Miles Standish, fearing an Indian attack, hearing rumors among the English people of Indian anger at the Puritans, decided instead on a peremptory, and of course there's no evidence that there was ever an Indian attack intended, decided on a peremptory attack on the Indians. This is what Zarco's referring to. Invited all the key chiefs of the Pokanokets and Massachusetts peoples around the Plymouth area to come for a feast. Fed them in different homes. And while they were eating, murdered them. And that's called the Wessagusset War. Yeah, it's called a war if the whites win. It's called a massacre if the Indians win. Even in the case of Custer, and he attacked the Indians. Hannah.
You've talked throughout today and yesterday about kind of the bad aspects of Euro-American culture, the good aspects of Indian culture, and it's been very, very convincing for me. But I would like to think that there are some good qualities as well of this culture that I'm part of and have grown up in. So I just wonder.
Well, it's a very powerful culture. I mean, look at the economic machine it has generated in the world now has consumed the world. And already 20 years ago, it was labeled the world system by Emanuel Wallerstein. I want to say this carefully. I mean, it's a terribly powerful culture. And yeah, we could get down to some parts of European culture that are nice, useful, warm, embraceable. What I'm trying to identify is that part of European culture that has created what I've called the culture of violence in the United States and in the world. And that, I don't think, is redeemable. And that, somehow, we've got to change. We've got to come up with a new vision to change the kind of violence that has been a part of European culture from before 1492. It just becomes apparent in the Americas with 1492. Paul.
I had an experience. I'm a college teacher, and I had an experience within that institution that might shed light on your question. And I've been thinking about this all the time you've been talking, that our cultural values are sometimes so powerful that they can even defeat the individual will that one person or that some individuals might have. And here's my example. Where I teach, like
I think that's true, by the way. That's really important.
Yeah, and I think it is. And I think the illustration that's concrete for me is Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, where I teach, was going through, like a lot of liberal arts colleges were 5 years ago, I guess, some real tight economic times. I stood up in front of the faculty, 150 people, and suggested that we take a $2,000 salary cut. Times 150 is $300,000 would be a big thing. The president stood up and just belittled the whole idea, and the faculty in general kind of, what kind of a stupid idea is that? Okay, that's the cultural milieu of the money value. But I can't tell you how many individuals came up to me afterwards and said, that's the only conscionable idea I've heard.
Yeah.
That's the only Christian thing to do. So the individual will said yes, but the corporate value said no.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful illustration because Western individualism ultimately crashes on its own coastline. Because the individual really has no power whatsoever. Decisions are made and imposed upon us by this system that not even a president can change.